This Weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This Weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Recovering from DC's chaos. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Much of the nation was shaken to its core as the deadly riots unfolded at the U.S. Capitol. Will anything good come out of it?
On the personal finance front, how to use lessons from the pandemic to set financial goals for this year.
Last year was forgettable for a number of reasons, but for space enthusiasts, 2020 was solid. We'll identify the reason why.
And how Alabama and Ohio State took very different paths to this Monday's college football national championship.
We know that Nick Saban is a coach that has a vaunted process, and everything he does is incredibly detail-oriented, and it looks like that served him well this year with the pandemic.
Lane Higgins at the Wall Street Journal on the road to Miami for the Crimson Tide and Buckeyes. Well, never in recent memory have the events of a single 24-hour period so shaken two presidencies, the very capital of the United States, and the nation itself, as they did this past Wednesday. So says Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at the Wall Street Journal. Jerry, will the tone of our debates now change after this?
Well, I think it's possible. You know, we keep saying that there's been a shock and people will now step back from the divisive political rhetoric and a political divide in general and act differently, and it doesn't happen. Maybe so here. I do think one of the things that will happen here is that President Trump's claim to be the leader of the Republican Party going forward has sustained a big hit here. I think it's going to be hard for a lot of Republican, certainly particular people in the Republican establishment, to accept that as the face of their party after Trump supporters basically, you know, breached security of the Capitol, vandalized the Capitol building itself, and sent Republican lawmakers into a lockdown, including Vice President Pence. And yeah. So I think that is one of the consequences here. I think maybe there's a chance everybody will step back a little bit here and say, let's cool the rhetoric. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, was already arguing that in his comments about the election challenge before the mob arrived on the Hill. So, you know, you think it's possible. You would like to think it's possible. At least a lot of people will. And we'll see. But it's not one of those days that people will forget soon. I think the consequences will play out for days, weeks, months, maybe even years to come.
All right. I know he wasn't responsible for breaking windows and climbing walls, things like that. Is President Trump to blame in some part in your mind?
Well, you know, look, he sort of set the fire here, you have to admit. I mean, he spoke at the rally near the White House. He said, we will never concede the election. We'll never stop fighting. You have been betrayed. You, he's saying to his supporters, have been betrayed by the Republican Party's leaders. They're weak and they're pathetic. Now let's walk up to the Capitol and make our feelings known, implying that he might go with them, which, of course, he didn't. And then we saw what happened in the aftermath. So, you know, people can assign blame as they want, but the reality is that this is now kind of the picture of the Trump movement for the time being, not the one the president wanted, I'm sure, but it was the manifestation, at least, of an anger that he stoked as recently as midday on Wednesday.
We're speaking with Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at the Wall Street Journal. He's written a piece entitled "A Single Day Shakes Two Presidencies, Two Parties, and One Nation to the Core." What was it like for you as a veteran of D.C. to see this stuff unfold?
Pretty remarkable. I mean, you know, I've been here for a long time, 40 years or so, and I've seen a lot of things, including the aftermath of 9/11, which was a kind of an atmosphere that I had never seen before, and shocking in a different way. But it was, you know, speaking of shaking people to the core, yeah. 9/11 did that. I don't think of anything that's happened since that had quite the same effect until Wednesday. And I just don't think I have ever seen, or nor would I have ever imagined, the very democratic processes that happen in the Capitol simply being disrupted and stopped, and a vice president being whisked into a lockdown to keep him safe from supporters of his own boss, the president. I mean, it's just kind of breathtaking if you think about it. And I think the question going forward is, how do the institutions recover from this? And it'll be interesting to see how members of Congress now conduct themselves.
Why did it seem that Washington, D.C. was not prepared for this?
Well, I don't think anybody anticipated that this would be the result of what everybody knew would be a march and a gathering of angry Trump protesters who clearly share with the president the belief that the election was not on the up and up. I mean, I think that sentiment is genuine on their part. They've been encouraged to believe that by the president and his supporters. But I don't think anybody anticipated that the outcome of that anger would be storming the Capitol. I think people expected, and certainly the Capitol Police were prepared for big groups of angry protesters around the Capitol, and they were supposed to be cordoned off and kept away from the building itself. Maybe they should have imagined this would happen. Clearly they didn't.
How does President-elect Joe Biden handle this now?
Well, in a way, I'm going to say this too glibly at all, but in a way it could turn out to help him. It kind of underscores the argument he's been making that we need to get beyond the divisive politics of recent times and move into a calmer, more civilized political debate here. I mean, that's certainly a point that seems relevant after what we saw on Wednesday. And, you know, I think it maybe helps him by compelling Republicans and Democrats to take a step back. And this is true of the people in the Republican Party on the right wing, but it's also true of the left wing of his own party, you know, people who want to have conflict and combat. And maybe he now has a little more leverage to say to people in his own party, the path forward here involves not demanding you get everything you want, but accepting compromise and consensus.
Thanks, Jerry. Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at the Wall Street Journal. New year, new budgets. Every small business has unique needs. And when you partner with a Dell Technologies advisor, you get real-time tailored advice. They'll even give you a free consultation on your servers and storage devices to develop a custom solution to help improve your company's productivity. Plus, get special financing with Dell Business Credit and big savings on business computers with Intel Core processors. Call a Dell Technologies advisor at 877-ASK-DELL.
This year, Michigan businesses have had to adapt, and the Michigan Economic Development Corporation was right there alongside them, helping to connect businesses to new resources, meet new partners, and access the additional capital they needed right from the start. If your business needs support to reach its new potential, the MEDC is available to help in any way we can. Contact us today for customized business assistance at michiganbusiness.org/partnership.
January is National Blood Donor Month, and a challenging time to collect blood donations due to the winter weather, not to mention a tough time because of the pandemic. Insight from Dr. Baya Lasky, Medical Director for the American Red Cross. Doctor, what's your message?
January is National Blood Donor Month, as you mentioned, because it coincides with one of the times of year for us that is traditionally difficult or challenging for us to maintain a sufficient blood supply for patients. And that has really been compounded by the challenges that we've had due to COVID. We've seen during the course of the pandemic so far tens of thousands of blood pulled, which has resulted in over 1 million units of blood not collected. So, you know, blood donations and blood products are an essential part of the healthcare process and, of course, health to our communities. So when we're challenged with collecting blood, that, of course, has a potential impact on healthcare.
Boy, have you ever been to a point where particular hospital or location, you've actually run out and have none to give for a few days or weeks, or how does that work?
We have been able to maintain supplies of our standard blood products like red cells and platelets, plasma. Where we're really starting to feel the pinch is with our convalescent plasma for the COVID-19 patients.
And that means what? Convalescent plasma means what?
So convalescent plasma is collected from individuals who have recovered from the COVID-19 disease, and we draw their plasma, and it contains antibodies against the virus that when it's transfused to someone who's currently infected with the virus, it helps to clear the virus faster. And so there's a huge demand for convalescent plasma. As we've seen the case numbers sadly rise throughout the country, the demand for convalescent plasma has paralleled that increase. And so we are very challenged with being able to keep up with demand. Right now, it's going out the door faster than it's coming in.
We're speaking with Dr. Baya Lasky, Medical Director for the American Red Cross. We're talking about donating blood, since January is National Blood Donor Month. How does the American Red Cross make it safe for people during a pandemic to come in and donate blood somewhere?
Sure, that's a great question. Blood donation has been determined to be an essential part of healthcare. And the Red Cross itself has implemented a number of safety measures in accordance with the CDC to help mitigate the spread of the virus, including we've implemented appropriate distancing at our drives and at our donor centers. We do health checks on all of our staff. We do temperature screening for everyone that comes through the door. We're doing health screening to make sure that we're not allowing anyone that comes in sick into the facilities. We're doing frequent wipe downs in between each donor and of all of our high touch areas, so that it's really, we're maintaining the safest environment possible. And COVID-19 is not transmissible through blood transfusion, and so there is very little risk to people who come into our donor centers.
Wow, all right, good point. How do you find a donor center, by the way?
We're encouraging people who think they're eligible to visit redcrossblood.org. There are actually two ways to donate convalescent plasma, which is in the greatest need right now. And that is, if someone has actually been diagnosed, they can sign up as a convalescent plasma donor directly. And with that process, we can actually obtain up to 4 units, which can treat up to 4 patients.
Thanks, Baya. Dr. Baya Lasky, Medical Director for the American Red Cross. Thanks for being with us. The paths to the 2021 College Football Playoff Championship could not have been any different for number 1 Alabama and number 3 Ohio State. They play Monday at Hard Rock Stadium in Miami at 8 o'clock for the national championship. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
In a season of chaos in college football, it all comes down to this: Alabama versus Ohio State for the national championship. How they got there was quite different, though. As Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal tells us, Alabama navigated the pandemic with little disruption, but OSU faced nothing but disruptions. Lane, how did Nick Saban and the Crimson Tide get through COVID-19 relatively unscathed?
Well, we know that Nick Saban is a coach that has a vaunted process, and everything he does is incredibly detail-oriented, and it looks like that served him well this year with the pandemic, and that he was very early on in preaching that everyone wear masks and social distance. And I think just, part of the program culture he's built is one of compliance and following rules, and it seems like that, obviously paid off. We don't know if there was an outbreak among the players at Alabama, because they're are not really any public data from the university about the testing that's been done there. But based on, depth charts and availability before game days, it looks like almost everyone has been around for most games, which is, not the case for a lot of teams. And the only person we know that got COVID is actually Coach Saban himself, who had a false positive first, but then actually got the virus the week of the Iron Bowl. And he hasn't said exactly how he thinks he got it, but it was around Thanksgiving, a time when the virus was spiking. Just based on odds, it's kind of understandable.
So do we think then that Coach Saban laid the groundwork so that players kept each other more accountable than perhaps some other teams and teams that were not in the running for a national championship?
I think so. And, maybe you can't say this about Alabama versus the other teams in the playoffs, but if you look at a team like Minnesota, where they were dealing with a pretty big outbreak right before their season started, and then once it became clear that, they'd lost a few games, cases had a huge spike. And I think for a lot of teams across the country, when it became clear that, you know, you maybe weren't going to be playing for a chance to be in the championship game for your conference or a New Year's Six Bowl, it kind of makes you question, you know, why you're making all these sacrifices. Because football in the college level is hard enough as it is before they tell you that, you know, you can't eat a meal with any of your friends, you can't see your family, you can't see your significant other. And, you know, a lot of the teams that went to the highest levels of college football this year and didn't have outbreaks, there was a lot that they gave up. And I think we're now reaching a point of the season where now that it's over, a lot of these coaches and players are opening up about, you know, just how stressful and taxing that was.
We're speaking with Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal. All right, Lane, so things were extremely different at Ohio State after a delayed start to the season. Ohio State's season really was fits and starts all along.
Right, and some of that was due to outbreaks within other teams, the Big Ten. So first, Ohio State's game against Maryland got canceled because of issues at Maryland. But then Ohio State had to cancel its own game at Illinois because of having issues there. And according to the athletic director, the positivity rate at Ohio State wasn't high enough to necessarily trigger a program pause based on the Big Ten's protocol. But they just figured it was best to try to contain the spread before it got much worse. And, you know, we don't know how bad it was. Ohio State doesn't release its data on testing. But we do know that when Ohio State did play the game against Michigan State, they were without something like 24 players and many, many starters. So it's clear that whether that was contact tracing or positive tests, you know, they were pretty undermanned. And we probably would have seen that again the following week when Ohio State was supposed to play Michigan, but Michigan had to cancel that because of a COVID outbreak there. So because of that, Ohio State's kind of been in this weird place where they keep trying to play games and then their opponent thwarts them or they thwart themselves. And because the Big Ten has such a lengthy return to play protocol, which was 21 days until the Big Ten title game and got reduced to 17. Because of that, it is, you know, really hard for some of these players to get back in action. Whereas someone like Trevor Lawrence, who tested positive in the ACC, he only had to miss, I think, 2 weeks and was able to, you know, sort of be practicing a little bit before then. So it's just a matter of being in a conference with strict protocols that had a weird start and then also, you know, having more cases of the virus than Alabama.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal sports reporter Lane Higgins. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. This year could be a huge one for space. We'll explain how. Also, setting your financial goals for 2021, plus a use for the old Sears stores. And how cold is too cold for a workout? We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, most people around the world are happy to see 2020 gone, but for space enthusiasts, last year was actually quite a good one, providing bits of promising news amid the bleak headlines of disease, economic hardship, and protests. It's a story by Christian Davenport at the Washington Post. Christian, what can we expect from NASA?
Well, they're going to keep launching astronauts. They had a test flight in May of 2020 and then an operational one with a full contingent of four astronauts, three from NASA, one from Japan, and they're just going to continue that pace. I mean, a lot of people forget that NASA, up until these SpaceX flights, did not have the ability to fly astronauts. That's because the space shuttle was retired in 2011. SpaceX is restoring that capability for NASA, and they've got two more flights with astronauts to the International Space Station coming up in 2021. So that's going to be a big thing for them.
Are there plans to get regular people aboard SpaceX at some point, Christian?
Yeah, and that's actually could come up in the second half or toward the end of 2021. It used to be the policy from NASA that private citizens weren't allowed to fly up to the International Space Station from American soil. They've revised that. And now there's a company called Axiom Space that is, on one hand, working to build its own commercial space station. Think of a sort of private hotel and platform in space, but also booking flights on SpaceX's Crew Dragon for wealthy individuals. We're talking, you know, you get to spend 10 days on the space station cost about $50 million for the right to be able to do that. So, you know, you've got to have a lot of money to be able to do this, but Axiom will train you, procure the transportation with SpaceX, and in this case, we'll have a sort of a guide. Michael Lopez Alegria, a former NASA astronaut who now works for Axiom Space. So that's another thing we could see coming in 2021, in addition to the suborbital space tourism that companies like Virgin Galactic, founded by Richard Branson, and Blue Origin, founded by Jeff Bezos, want to do. And they want to start taking people on trips just to the edge of space and back.
What is the Starship spacecraft?
Well, that is Elon Musk's dream in a lot of ways. It's his next generation spacecraft. That would be, when this thing gets going, massive, and be able to take about 100 people or so to the moon or to Mars. So now it's Falcon 9 rocket and it's Dragon spacecraft. SpaceX uses those to take astronauts and cargo and supplies to the International Space Station. That is in Earth orbit. That's about 250 miles away. They're now working on SpaceX's a much bigger vehicle, Starship, that would be fully reusable to go to the moon and on to Mars. They're working on developing that right now at their launch site in Boca Chica, Texas, outside of Brownsville, the very southernmost tip of Texas. And they're doing demonstration flights, all of, working right up till the new year. And that will be a big thing for 2021. And Elon hopes that that vehicle will finally make orbit for the first time next year.
We're speaking with Christian Davenport at The Washington Post. His piece is called 2021 Could Be a Huge Year for Space. Here's what's to come from NASA, Elon Musk, Richard Branson, and Jeff Bezos. What's the plan to get more satellites in orbit, and for what purpose?
Well, so this is yet another SpaceX endeavor. They are quite busy. They've got a program called Starlink that would put up not just hundreds or many hundreds, but thousands of satellites into Earth orbit. And they're very small, and they put up about 60 at a time for every launch. And the idea is that they would beam down the internet to ground stations. You could, just sort of buy one of these, put it on your roof, and you would get a satellite internet beamed down from space. Now, this isn't for, highly dense and highly populated urban areas that already have access to broadband. I mean, the latency, and it would just be far too difficult to get that from space. But it's for rural areas, areas that are underserved or not served at all by broadband, and helping those communities get online. There is an estimated 4 billion people in the world that don't have access to the internet. And Starlink is one of a few attempts to put up these internet constellations in space. I mean, Amazon also wants to do this. It's got a program it calls Kuiper, and there's a company called OneWeb that wants to do this as well. It's a very risky proposition, very expensive. There have been other companies that have tried to do this in the past, but have failed. So we're going to see, I think 2021 will be a big year to see who is able to succeed in this and who is not.
Thanks, Christian. Christian Davenport, reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Drawing up a list of financial resolutions for the new year isn't the routine exercise it once was. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed that, as it has altered so many other behaviors. Here's what to consider from Russ Wiles, personal finance reporter at the Arizona Republic. Russ, what do you recommend?
I think there's a few different wrinkles, Gordon. I mean, year in and year out, the usual financial resolutions come up. The three most popular this year, for example, are, cut debt, reevaluate spending, try and save more. That's according to a Fidelity survey. Nothing really unusual about that. But I think the COVID pandemic has changed some of those, put some tweaks or some different nuances on some of those money resolutions.
All right, so tackle the first one then, evaluating spending in your budget. How do you think about that differently in the wake of the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a good example. I mean, anybody who's trying to budget, they start by looking at last year's expenses, where they spent money, and their income returns, of course. Well, last year, people's spending was disrupted. Let's face it. I mean, you probably didn't go out to restaurants as much. You probably didn't drive your car nearly as much. certainly you didn't travel as much. So maybe those are ways, you know, we learn to live without some of these expenses. Maybe last year, out of necessity, maybe we can, you know, if money is tight, maybe that's an issue. Some of these areas we can learn to, you know, cut back permanently.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, too, that insurance needs came up. How does that factor in here?
Well, that's another example. I mean, let's face it, most people are not driving nearly as much as they did. Certainly, if you're studying or working from home, you probably don't, you know, you're not using your car as much. And, you know, that could be an area of saving by itself. But in addition, with fewer cars on the road, there's been a marked decrease in accidents. And insurance companies have been lowering premiums as a result of, you know, fewer claims. But this is another area that people might want to shop around for, reconsider their insurance. I mean, it's not a bad idea to, you know, shop around for insurance, you know, every year or two anyway. Mm-hmm. But there could be some good cost savings around if you select an insurer who really has been, you know, passing those savings along to customers.
We're speaking with Russ Wiles, personal finance reporter at the Arizona Republic, part of the USA Today network. He's written a piece entitled, "When Setting Your Financial Goals for 2021, Consider These Lessons from the Pandemic." You said, too, plan for an unreliable tax refund. Explain that.
Well, the last, you know, in 2020 was kind of a chaotic year for the IRS and many of the state tax agencies. Not only were, in some cases, stimulus payments delayed, but some people had their 2019 tax refunds, you know, pushed back by months. And, you know, this is because the IRS had, like every other, you know, large employer, had, you know, office shutting problems due to the pandemic. They were slowed down. And, well, I found it interesting that the IRS actually made a small comment in a press release they put out just a couple of weeks ago, warning people that they shouldn't rely on receiving a refund by a certain date. Mm. And this is important for a lot of people because for some, the annual tax refund that they receive is the largest chunk of money they'll get all year.
Right.
And they rely on it to pay off debts or to make big ticket purchases, whatever. So the IRS is actually warning people, don't, you know, it's not going to be coming perhaps with the same precision in terms of timing as it has in the past. And given that so many people are, you know, living hand to mouth anyway or paycheck to paycheck, I just think it underscores the need to build up at least some small cash reserves or emergency reserves to tide you over if that tax refund is a few weeks and possibly even a couple months late.
Yeah. What did you mean by invest in yourself?
Well, I think it's always a good idea to re-educate yourself, whether it's on, you know, or to learn more, whether it's on financial literacy skills or, you know, maybe a side gig, something like that. Let's face it, the coronavirus pandemic this year really disrupted the employment market, and a lot of people not only were pushed out of their regular jobs, but needed to get part-time work. So I just think if you wanted to, you know, set a financial goal broadly for this year, maybe, you know, you learn how to do some new skills or you pick up some added knowledge about how to invest your money, save your money, whatever. You know, you invest in yourself, just improve your, with an eye on improving yourself.
Thanks, Russ. Russ Wiles, personal finance reporter at the Arizona Republic.
Innovation, resilience, agility. It's how Michigan businesses continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and proven adaptability are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
New year, new budgets. Every small business has unique needs. And when you partner with a Dell Technologies advisor, you get real-time tailored advice. They'll even give you a free consultation on your servers and storage devices to develop a custom solution to help improve your company's productivity. Plus, get special financing with Dell Business Credit and big savings on business computers with Intel Core processors. Call a Dell Technologies advisor at 877-ASK-DELL. Glad you're with us. This portion of the program is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. Well, Americans are heading back to Sears, but not to shop. Public health agencies and healthcare organizations from Iowa to Florida are using some of the hundreds of closed Sears department stores to help with the nationwide effort to administer COVID-19 vaccines. It's a story by Sarah Krause, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Sarah, what's happening?
So these are stores that have a lot of space on the inside. They usually have very large parking lots, and they're usually pretty centrally located in communities close to highways, easily accessible. So the same things that used to draw shoppers and retailers are now attractive to public health officials who are looking for hubs that they can use to vaccinate as quickly as possible their communities.
All right. So how does it work? How do you design one of these things to be a vaccine center?
You know, there's a couple of different approaches that I've come across. In some, it's simply using the inside of the Sears store. So you have people parking the parking lot, walk in, check in, maybe even line up inside, and then move through a registration table, an actual, like, behind-the-curtain appointment to get the vaccine. And then you sit in a waiting area for 30 minutes for observation, and they try to space it out such that you can adhere to social distancing guidelines. At other locations, they've started to use Sears auto garages, so the places where you might have gone for an oil change. You drive your car in, roll down the window, and get your vaccine through the window, and then you drive to the parking lot area where you sit for observation, and there's officials that sort of walk around to observe you and make sure that recipients of the vaccine haven't had adverse reactions.
How about that? So is it not just Sears then? Could it be any of these kind of large department stores that seem to be going vacant?
That's right. It's not just Sears. We've seen them at Kmart's. We've seen them really in these anchor type facilities within malls. So that when you think about the sort of aging, sort of dying mall with its large anchor space that could have been occupied by any number of retailer, that space has sat vacant in a lot of communities for a long time. And so, you know, they've become these obvious candidates for vaccine sites. And in some places, they were already, whether it's just the parking lot or even parts of these old malls, were being used for COVID testing sites, partly because they have the big parking lot. You can set up lots of lanes where people can line up and drive through. And now that's being expanded to include vaccine administration.
We're speaking with Sarah Krause, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. She's written an interesting piece entitled, Finally, A Use for the Old Sears COVID-19 Vaccine Center. I get the sense in some of these cases, slightly off the subject here, but there might be a race to snatch this space from Amazon, which seems to be taking a lot of these stores for fulfillment centers.
You know, I think that a lot of malls are, you know, for years have been struggling with what's next for us. Do we redevelop the site? Do we try to find alternate uses? In a lot of places, you've seen entertainment spaces come in, whether it's like a bouncy castle or laser tag or, you know, any sort of like fun things for families that become a draw, or even gyms, you know, starting up gyms in those facilities. Obviously, the pandemic has changed that equation on, you know, wanting to have places where people gather. And so you've had, you know, sort of even more pronounced shutdowns than what was already happening in that space. You do have, you know, the likes of Amazon jockeying for some spaces, but I think there is this sort of high level question with what do we do with this space? What is the best use of it?
Yeah. Explain what the Cayuga Health System went through in upstate New York. I know you took a look at kind of what things they considered.
Yeah, they're a good example of this, you know, how these big empty retail spaces are starting to be used. So when they started to look for COVID testing sites way back early last year, they wanted places that were easy to access. They needed large parking lots where they could set up tents, you know, because you have the people administering the tests in all different weather scenarios. So you want to have some sort of shelter. And then you want some sort of storage space for the protective gear and other supplies that you need to do the testing.
Thanks, Sarah. Sarah Krause, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Well, COVID-19 forced gyms to get creative with their offerings in 2020, moving workouts online and outdoors. As the pandemic stretched into winter, renewed lockdown measures across the northern U.S. are leaving some gym owners and members with no place to go but back outside. But the Wall Street Journal says a number of gyms are taking over rooftops, parks, and empty lots to help people build up a cold sweat all winter. Independent studios have been leading the way, while boutique chains like SoulCycle, Barry's, and Cycle Bar have also set up outdoor locations in the Northeast. The surprising popularity of some classes has some gyms wondering if they'll keep them going beyond the pandemic. Cindy Brower, founder of Mojo Fitness, a studio in Wayne, Pennsylvania, told the Journal that she moved her dance-based workouts to a nearby amphitheater. There's enough space to go maskless and blast the music. She set the original temperature limit at 40 degrees, but it's now at 33. One concern for some gym operators, the computers on things like stationary bikes and rowing machines may freeze at extreme temperatures, and snow, of course, can collapse your outdoor canopy that protects some of the equipment. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. geico.com. Easy.